Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The management of non-small cell lung cancer has changed dramatically in recent years, particularly in the adjuvant and first-line metastatic settings. I met with Dr. Paul Bunn for his take on the clinical implications of emerging research data in these settings, and he began by commenting on his non-protocol approach to patients with metastatic disease.
In the palliative setting, because of the convenience and less toxicity of carboplatin, the vast majority of people in the U.S. tend to use carboplatin. So generally, off of a study, I will use Taxol and carboplatin, and that's because I've used it so much and the staff is so familiar with it, you're less likely to run into issues because everybody's familiar with it. So when the patient calls up 4 days later with myalgias, everybody knows what that is. Now, certainly a patient who's female and wants to keep their hair, and I certainly discuss this with every patient, they're certainly much more likely to get GEM, in my practice, probably GEM with carbo. Certainly, you know, the recent study that compared Olympus-Cis with GEM-Cis, showing non-inferiority, and this business about the adenos did better with Olympta and the squamous did better with GEM, that's something to keep your eye on. But I would say that's just a subset analysis of a big trial and doesn't create reality at the moment, but was of interest for sure. So platinum doublet, toxicity, convenience, that's how you decide. And I would say the main toxicity that makes people decide is their hair.
What about Bev?
So bevacizumab, there are two randomized phase 3 trials, one from the U.S. with carboplatin and Taxol, and was the ECOG study, and showed a survival benefit with a hazard ratio that is clinically relevant to me and similar to practice-changing studies with other things. So for the way the study was done, that is non-squamous, no brain mets, no hemoptysis, no anticoagulants, I think in the U.S., most people will use bevacizumab, and I certainly will. It's certainly reasonable to give bevacizumab to people who are bevacizumab eligible on the ECOG study. And then there's a couple of questions, of course. Bevacizumab has been used quite a bit in gliomas, and there's a study going on now testing it in people with brain mets. So if you have a radiated brain met, do you really not have to give bevacizumab? And then if you're on Coumadin or subcutaneous heparin, there's a question of whether it's okay to give bevacizumab as well. I generally don't at the moment, but I've certainly been tempted at times.
How about the brain met, treated brain met situation? Have you done that?
I've treated some patients who've had irradiated brain mets. That's not routine, but I certainly have done that. What's really missing is the final survival data from the European trial. The European trial had two major differences. The first is that the chemotherapy was gemcitabine-based instead of Taxol-based. And second of all, they used two doses of bevacizumab, 7.5 milligrams per kilogram and 15 milligrams per kilogram. The primary endpoint of the study was progression-free survival, and they met that endpoint, and that's what's been released. The survival data has not yet been presented. In the progression-free survival, there wasn't a difference between 7.5 and 15. But the differences seemed less striking than the differences in the ECOG study. So whether the chemotherapy matters is not really determined. Whether the dose of bevacizumab matters hasn't really been determined. So my take on that is to continue to use Taxol and carboplatin with bevacizumab at 15 milligrams per kilogram.
Once the patient is on that therapy, how many chemotherapy cycles do you utilize, and do you then continue the Bev as in the trial?
Right. The majority of patients, but certainly not all, will get 4 cycles of chemotherapy. Now, obviously, if you're progressing, you're going to get fewer. If you're still responding after 4, you would give more. And that happens occasionally, but in the minority of patients. What was done in the ECOG study was to continue the bevacizumab, so that's basically what I do and what the standard is. Now, certainly a major study question is whether that maintenance Avastin is really needed. one of the striking things is that when you get a patient who's responding or benefiting from erlotinib or gefitinib, they stay on it for a long time. You know, the maintenance bevacizumab doesn't last for years. It lasts for months at best. But there's two questions. One is, does that maintenance do anything? Then when the patient progresses and they're getting their next therapy, should they get bevacizumab? And that's not been answered either.
There was some intriguing data presented at the 2007 ASCO meeting in colon cancer by Axel Grothe of the BRIGHT Tumor Registry, which actually led to a prospective study that's being done right now in colon to answer that exact question, should you keep the Bev going? But it looked actually kind of surprisingly encouraging. We had our think tank this summer, and the investigators were pretty interested in that. Where do you think that whole issue is going to head? Do you think we're going to be in a situation maybe where an agent like Bev or some other angiogenic agent would maybe continued indefinitely?
I don't know about indefinitely. I mean, certainly I've given bevacizumab to patients in first line and second line. If they're progressing pretty quickly in the second line, it's a little hard to imagine how it's going to help in the third line. So I can see it in a couple lines of treatment, but indefinite, probably not.
What about side effects and toxicity once you bring bevacizumab on board, and specifically the issue of hemoptysis? What do you say to patients? What do you do clinically? Are there situations that maybe in addition to the ones that you mentioned where you back off because of concerns for hemoptysis?
Well, I think hemoptysis is the biggest absolute contraindication to using the drug, and I think it's a contraindication if you had it before you started, and if you get it while you're on bevacizumab, I think you got to stop the bevacizumab right away. One of the predictive factors for pulmonary hemorrhage, one of the strongest ones, is certainly the existence of hemoptysis. So certainly, if a patient's had hemoptysis, they shouldn't get bevacizumab, and if they get hemoptysis while they're on it, it should be stopped. Now, there's two issues. One's a half-life, 20 days. So you got to watch them carefully if they develop hemoptysis when they're on it. Then the question is, what's hemoptysis? If a patient had two flecks of blood after a bronchoscopy, that's probably not hemoptysis. I don't know that there's any data about measuring it, but if people are aware that they've had hemoptysis on more than one occasion, I'm not anxious to give them bevacizumab.
What about hypertension? What have you observed there?
About 20% of the people need to be treated for their hypertension. I've never had a patient that I couldn't control the hypertension, but it's certainly common. It's one of the more common side effects, for sure.
Any other side effects that you've observed yourself?
Well, the proteinuria. But again, the proteinuria usually can be controlled. And I haven't had anybody who had renal impairment. A nephrologist asked me the other day if patients had had a renal biopsy and what they showed, and I couldn't answer that question.
What about other agents in combination with bevacizumab? What do we know about that?
Well, so we know the study from Europe, which seems similar, at least, to the Taxol carboplatin. Then we know in the second-line setting, there was the randomized phase 2 trial of chemotherapy, take your pick, docetaxel or Alimta, or docetaxel or Alimta with bevacizumab or erlotinib with bevacizumab, and the two arms with the bevacizumab seem to be better than chemo alone. And so that adds two more drugs, Alimta and docetaxel. So it doesn't seem to matter what the chemotherapy is.
You mentioned the other trial looking at pemetrexate. Where do you think that's heading over the next couple of years? Do you see it maybe coming into the first-line setting?
Well, if that data that Alimta is superior to gemcitabine and adenocarcinomas were to hold up, or if there were a biologic, they hypothesized that it might be TS levels or MTAP levels. So that needs to be pursued. It would be nice for chemotherapy, just like targeted therapies, to have a biologic marker that you could use to say that you ought to use this chemo or that chemo. Will that actually happen? It's hard to know. Alimta is clearly an equivalent doublet in the first line, clearly a little more expensive now because most of the other drugs are generic now, and that'll be a much bigger issue in Europe than in the U.S., but it's certainly an issue. But if gemcitabine turned out to be superior in squamous and Alimta turned out to be superior in adeno, I think probably see people treated with adeno with Alimta and squamous with Taxol or gemcitabine.
What do you see in terms of side effects, quality of life, when patients receiving pemetrexate in combinations with Bev, et cetera?
Oh, Alimta is a well-tolerated drug, probably the best-tolerated drug, but it's interesting. In the old days, cisplatin used to be a terrible drug. With the antiemetics we have now, cisplatin is a lot easier to take than it was in the old days, so it's not as much of an advantage. The counts don't go down as much. The fatigue isn't as much. You don't lose your hair. So it's well tolerated, but you still give it with cis or carbo. And so in the first line setting, it's an advantage, but not, I don't think it's a dominant advantage.
How do you think through the second line decision?
Second line treatment is an issue because several drugs, docetaxel, Alimta, and gefitinib and erlotinib have all been tested and basically have a beneficial effect. So the largest comparative trial was presented this year in Seoul. It was called the INTEREST trial, where docetaxel was compared to gefitinib. And there was absolutely no difference. And so that would certainly probably lean people to use gefitinib because there was less toxicity from the gefitinib. There was also, of course, the trial of Alimta versus docetaxel, and again, the survival was identical, but the Alimta is basically the winner because it had a lot less toxicity. But there's never really been a comparison of Alimta versus gefitinib or erlotinib, so you can't really have a direct comparison. So then the issues, since ERISA is not approved in this country, who do you use erlotinib in, and who do you use Alimta in? Or if we use the generic names, pemetrexed or erlotinib. So one of the things that used to seem to be a little bit of an issue was in the original second and third line studies, it didn't seem to matter how many chemos you'd had first, and it didn't seem to matter in terms of the effectiveness of erlotinib, whether you got it right after you progressed on the chemotherapy or whether you got chemotherapy, responded, and then did better. And that does seem to matter with chemotherapy. So one could say that that would make you use erlotinib in people who've progressed on chemo. That also has the advantages. You don't get a whole bunch of chemo right in a row on your bone marrow. In this gefitinib versus docetaxel study, it was second or third line. And in the third line, interestingly enough, the docetaxel did a little bit better. So one could argue there's trivial data that it's better to give the TKI in the second line and Alimta in the third line. I don't think it matters. If a patient progresses on their initial chemotherapy, you know, if they've had four cycles and their bone marrow's beat up and they're beat up, I'll tend to use the TKI. If they haven't had anything in a while, I give them a choice. In an academic center, of course, we have the luxury of there's lots of trials for those patients.
What about the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab?
So that's clearly a good combination, and the trial, I understand, is within single digits of completing its accrual. So all we have is that randomized phase two that I told you about, that we discussed earlier. And so that study certainly suggests that it's better than erlotinib alone. And fortunately, in another year, we'll have the answer to that.
You mentioned that you tend to use carbo-paclitaxel. What are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel? There's a lot of interest and discussion about nab in breast cancer. What about nab in lung cancer?
Well, the phase two trials have been completed, and it's active. It looks like Taxol, more convenient. There's randomized phase three trials going on, and they're largely being conducted outside the U.S. If they're negative, that's probably the end of it in lung cancer. If they're positive, then the question is what share of the market would they get? And that depends on the magnitude of the differences in the phase three trials. And
when you say they're positive, I guess there are two issues there. One is what the efficacy is going to be. And in breast cancer, it's kind of been interesting. I sort of been surprised to see that It actually looks like maybe it actually has more activity than paclitaxel, maybe docetaxel. But then the other is the issue of the side effects, convenience, shorter infusion, and particularly the lack of pre-medications and steroids. Clearly, if it's got an efficacy advantage, as you say, that's one issue. What about the other issue, the side effects? How do you see that playing out in lung cancer and breast? A lot of patients and docs seem to value that. How about lung?
Well, lung cancer patients are sicker to begin with than breast cancer patients, and so theoretically that might have a bigger advantage in lung than in breast. I think that in Europe, it's not going anywhere unless there was a big survival advantage. In the U.S., I think it would capture some market, and I haven't used it enough to know. In the old days, when you used to give cisplatin to a patient and then you'd give them carbo, you knew. It was meaningful. I mean, it was a toxicity difference that patients cared about. Here, I don't have enough experience to probably have looked better. I probably would talk to some of my breast cancer colleagues about that.
Again, you know, as you say, it's different. The patient who's anorectic, losing weight, having a lot of problems, and lung cancer is one thing. You know, a breast cancer patient who's active, working, things like insomnia, agitation, diabetes, things like that from steroids maybe play out. And I'm not sure about the mix typically for a first-line lung cancer patient. Metastatic disease, clearly probably be older, more frail. But I guess there are plenty of healthier, younger people with lung cancer too.
Well, that's the group that's come that we're all seeing more and more, and we're all perplexed. I mean, I saw a guy yesterday, he was 29, he was 25 when he started, 25 years old, never a smoker, unbelievable.
Wow, amazing.
That's the youngest I've ever seen.
Actually, Rogerio Lilienbaum presented on this series, he had to present a bunch of cases, a 30-year-old non-smoking one with lung cancer. Yeah, it's really amazing. I've been looking at a lot of statistics, not to get too far off the topic, but you know, when you look at the disease called lung cancer in non-smokers, if you look at it as a separate disease in terms of the numbers, and if you want to maybe throw in oligosmokers, the estimates I've heard from people are anywhere from 15 to 20% of lung cancer. Do you agree with that?
Never smokers, meaning less than 100 cigarettes in their life, or in the past have been reported to be about 15% of the U.S. population, higher in women, 20, lower in men, 10. Certainly, I think clinicians have the impression that that's increasing.
So even if it's 20%, if you think about it, it's kind of like, for example, 20% of breast cancer is HER2-positive breast right. cancer. That now is a different disease. So if you look at it just as that, and then you just take the numbers, because the numbers on lung cancer are so huge, that disease...
34,000.
Yeah. And then maybe, is it really the same number of deaths proportionally? I don't know. But if it is... You know, you're looking at a major disease comparable to, say, pancreatic cancer and impact.
Oh, yeah, bigger than stomach cancer, sure. 34,000 would be a very common cancer. Those patients usually have stage 4 disease, so I think that those tumors tend to metastasize early as well. Now, they clearly have a better prognosis and live better, and I'm sure there are going to be many biologic differences.
Well, one of the issues, of course, is the TKIs and the role in these patients and where it sort of fits in the algorithm. And, of course, EGFR testing. And, of course, your center has done some sentinel work in that regard. Can you talk a little bit about that whole arena, the enriched population, non-smokers, mutations, et cetera, and where we are today with that?
Right. You know, in the second and third line setting, it's not all that important because the patients... you know, have failed chemotherapy, and they're going to get a TKI almost no matter what. Where it really matters is in the first-line setting, and it's going to matter even more in the adjuvant setting. If you have a population where you reduce the hazard rate of death by half, hazard ratio of 0.5, that's going to have a significant impact on cure rate in early-stage disease. And so where that testing is really important is going to be in early stage and in first-line treatment. Hopefully we'll get to the point, like breast cancer, when you first have a diagnosis, you get the biologic properties of the tumor, and so you know what they are. And I think we're going to be there within 5 years. I don't think it's going to take us 10 years to actually get there. Now, there's no question, if you had a single clinical feature to pick, you would pick never smoking. And that's because EGFR mutations, EGFR gene amplification, are the highest in that group, and KRAS mutations almost never occur in never smokers. Personally, I think that skin rash and clinical features are probably not going to be the best way to select patients for any treatment. They may enrich patients for some biologic feature, but then if they're just enriching for the biologic feature, why not do the biologic feature? Because there's clearly smokers who have unbelievable benefit, and there's clearly never smokers who don't. So why not do the biologic testing?
What do we know about the response to TKIs in non-smokers who don't have mutations?
If they have high gene copy number, they're going to do well. And that's a considerable
fraction. Suppose they don't.
They're not likely to do well.
We have now, data to know that?
Yeah, well, we have data, but you're talking about, well, if you were looking at gene copy number, there's probably about a third of the patients that would be negative. So you're talking about a third of 20%. So you're not talking about, we have huge numbers, but it appears that even in never smokers, the biologic features can predict.
Can you kind of review where we are in terms of testing? You mentioned copy number, FISH, that you all have done so much interesting work on, mutation analysis, et cetera. Where are we right now? Where do you think we're going to be in a couple of years?
The interesting thing is these tests are available at many commercial laboratories now, and they're not ordered as much as you might think. And that's because in lung cancer, when people have their original diagnostic biopsies, the pathologists are not routinely sending it off the way they are. And the clinician isn't thinking about, in general, using the TKIs in the first-line setting. And so the tests aren't getting done, even though they're out there commercially. Now, we have a study where patients have their tumor tested, and then they're randomized, if they're positive, to erlotinib alone or erlotinib alternating with chemotherapy. Okay, so if these patients who are on TKIs for 4, 5, 6 years, they never stop. They never go off for side effects. They wouldn't even dream of it. If you could identify those patients in the beginning and they didn't get chemotherapy, if you said to a patient, I got a pill for you, or I got chemotherapy, okay, and 5 years from now you're still going to be on the pill and not have had any chemotherapy, or I'm going to give you chemo now, they'd all pick the pill. And they'd say, well, we're going to get better chemotherapy and less toxic chemotherapy 5 years from now when I need it. So we are back where tamoxifen was years ago. The TKIs in people who are sensitive arrest cells in G1. Okay, chemotherapy, most of them, taxanes, are killing cells in G2M. It's not a good thing to be giving them at the same time. So the question is, should they be given sequentially? That's what happened in breast. But there's that question that was asked in breast. If you could arrest cells in G1, take them off the drug, get them to start cycling, would you actually get a better effect by alternating them? And that question really needs to be answered.
It was the old Mark Lipman study, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
exactly.
He gave him estrogen.
It didn't work, right. But it's the same theory here. Maybe it won't work either, but it really should be tested before it's discarded.
What about the pragmatics in terms of the types of tests that are being done and which ones maybe are more useful?
Right, there are four tests that we need to talk about at the moment. First, let's look at EGFR. So you have immunohistochemistry, and there is pretty good data that if you're totally negative, which is about 10, at most 15% of people, that not only is there no benefit, there may actually be harm. Almost all the studies in EGFR negative patients have a hazard ratio of above 1, which is very interesting. But it doesn't discriminate very well people who might have a teeny benefit or no benefit from those that will have a lot of benefit. Okay, so then you have gene copy number. So now instead of 90% of the patients positive, you have roughly 40% of the patients positive.
And this is the EGFR gene?
EGFR gene. This is true gene amplification and high gene copy number, high polysomy, which is what's defined as a positive test for FISH for EGFR. So That, in the big studies, the hazard ratio, if you're positive there, has been around 0.4 to 0.5. Very good. Very similar to Fish and Herceptin. So if you have mutations, depending on the mutation, there are differences. If you have a deletion 19 mutation in EGFR, the hazard ratio is about 0.25. The response rate's like 80%, and the survival advantage is huge for those patients. Now, you're talking in North America, at the highest, EGFR mutations in 10%, and the exon 19 deletions are half of those, so that's 5% at most, okay? So certainly, if you got an exon 19 deletion, you're going to have a profound benefit, but it's a small fraction, and certainly there are many people that benefit beyond those. And then the fourth test is the KRAS mutation, which is a negative predictor predominantly for response. There's almost no responders in people who have had KRAS mutation. And whether there's a survival detriment, probably not, doesn't have a huge effect. So my guess is that ultimately we'll be doing two tests.
Fish and the mutation?
Yeah. But, you know, immunohistochemistry.
Or RAS.
You know, the pathologists, they do TTF1 and cytokeratin and immunohistochemistry on every lung cancer patient when they get it in there. I just hope that EGFR just becomes one of the standard battery of tests that are done. So I see no reason why the immunohistochemistry wouldn't just be in the battery of tests that's ordered as soon as you know, the pathologist does do it with, even without an order. You know, you don't have to order TTF1 on a lung cancer patient. It's done on everybody.
But specifically, which exact, all four of those tests you think should be done? Which tests should be done?
Well, I think immunohistochemistry, FISH, and mutation.
Why not KRAS?
Because I don't think if you do those others that it adds anything. Now, you'll get disagreement. Some people will say just do KRAS, and if it's positive, don't give it, and if it's negative, give it.
How much concordance is there between FISH and the mutation?
So almost everybody who's mutated has high copy number, but obviously there's 35% of people who have high copy number that are not mutated.
You know, I was just thinking, has copy number for EGFR been looked at with, like, cetuximab, you know,
yeah,
colon cancer?
Yeah, so it's a huge, it's probably more important with cetuximab than it is with the TKI. So this Southwest Oncology Group did a study where you got carboplatin and cetuximab concurrent versus carboplatin, cetuximab after the carboplatin, sequential, okay, based on the original. It was presented this year at ASCO. They had an 11-month median survival in both arms, better than anticipated in both arms. Purpose of the study was to pick a winner to go into a randomized phase 3 trial. Both arms did well. So FISH analysis was done on the majority of patients, not all of them. So FISH was significantly associated with response time to progression and survival. In FISH-positive patients, median survival was 16 months. In FISH-negative patients, the median survival was 8 months. And half of the patients were FISH-positive. So the median survival with bevacizumab in the highly selected good prognosis patients, 12 and a half months. Now, it doesn't prove anything, but in FISH-positive patients, the median survival was 16 months. So what SWOG is going to propose to do to the NCI is the standard treatment is either carboplatin or carboplatin-bev, depending on whether you're BEV eligible, and then people are going to be randomized to cetuximab or not.
With the BEV 2?
With the BEV 2. They've done a phase 2 of carboplatin, BEV, cetuximab already.
So I know that EGFR by IHC tanked in colon cancer, predicting a response to the cetuximab, but I'm trying to remember if I've heard that copy number has been looked at with colon and cetuximab. Has it?
No, and it needs to be.
Wow.
And it needs to be in head and neck as
well. Yeah, head and neck too, of course.
If you look at cell lines in both colon and head and neck, it works.
So that's been a huge source of frustration in terms of cetuximab.
Well, the company
not
was very
drug.
Slow to look at FISH, so I think they are now. I mean, they are aware of the SWOG data now, and they're going to look in the, you know, the difference between 099 and FLEX, right?
No.
Okay, so in the U.S., BMS ImClone did a study of carboplatin with or without cetuximab. And in Europe, they did a study of navalbean cysts, with or without cetuximab. That's called the FLEX trial. So the U.S. trial is called 099, and the European trial is called FLEX.
Okay.
So the preliminary results were announced. And so the data on 09900 were presented by Tom Lynch.
Hmm.
And that study failed to meet the primary endpoint. Now, the primary endpoint in that study was independent investigator progression-free survival. And it just missed. All the secondary endpoints were met, which was a higher response rate, a longer time to progression by the investigator, okay? And the survival data have not been presented. Now, that study had no eligibility requirements. There was no testing.
Did they look at fish?
They didn't look at fish or immunohistochemistry.
Hmm.
Now, in the FLEX trial, the immunohistochemistry was done, and if it was negative, you were not eligible. And in the FLEX study, the primary endpoint was overall survival. And what was announced was that was met. Okay, so the question is it the endpoint difference? Is it the fact that they didn't exclude the patients? And we don't even know the survival data now.
Sounds like the logical combination would be erlotinib and cetuximab.
Certainly Carlos Ardiaga and Jose Baselga and some others have preclinical data that there's benefit from combining EGFR agents. Another strategy might be to give chemotherapy and cetuximab and then follow it with erlotinib. Whether we'll ever get a trial like that, but that theoretically might be a very good strategy.
Where do you think things are heading in terms of other TKIs? One we've heard a lot about is 6474, Zactima.
Right. So now we're switching into the TKIs that are blocking VEGF receptor. And 6474 is a unique compound that blocks VEGF receptor because it also blocks EGFR. And it's one of the further along in clinical testing in terms of phase 3 trials. We don't have the results yet, but certainly it's in a couple of phase 3 trials. So theoretically, that would be great. That would be like bevacizumab and erlotinib. But there's a few complications. The first is, as we discussed before, giving an EGFR TKI at the same time as chemo may not be so beneficial, could be actually antagonistic. And the VEGF, the angiogenesis agents, have not too much activity on their own, but seem to potentiate chemotherapy and other drugs a whole lot. So one of the problems with Zactima, most of the studies have been with chemotherapy. The hypothesis there, when they did docetaxel with 100, a dose of 100 of 6474 versus 300, you would have thought, well, the 300 is going to win, but the best arm was the 100. At the 100 dose, you're getting quite a bit of VEGF receptor inhibition, but not much EGFR inhibition. So giving Zactima with chemotherapy might not be such a hot thing, except for the VEGF effect. You really want to give it with the chemotherapy.
Maybe you give it at the low dose during the chemo, and then once the chemo stops, you bump the dose up. I know that's a crazy idea.
It's a great idea, but whether you can do that or not. But despite...
Not to mention that all the kinetic stuff that we've been hearing in the last 30 years, I still really wonder what it means, but...
Yeah, well, in point of fact, the trials are being done, so we'll find out. You know, it has the advantage of hitting two targets at once. It has the disadvantage that that might not be ideal, and it might be better to use individual agents at the time you want.
The last thing I want to ask you about is adjuvant therapy, and specifically your take on the new ECOG, a major adjuvant study looking at chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, plus or minus bevacizumab. Can you talk about the design of that study, what's been going on in terms of discussion about that study, and where you think things are heading?
So there are three very important adjuvant trials now, and the hope is that they'll all accrue. So the one that started first is actually a trial called Radiant, and that's testing Tarceva. And in that study, patients can have adjuvant chemo or not have adjuvant chemo. So if you have a patient with stage 1B and you don't give them adjuvant treatment, they can be eligible. If you have a patient with stage 2 who's had a lot of side effects from the surgery and doesn't want chemo, that patient's eligible. Or a patient who's had chemo and the chemo's over is eligible. In that study, you have to be immunohistochemistry positive and or FISH positive, and there's two primary endpoints. One is a hazard ratio of something like 0.75 in immunohistochemistry positive patients, and then a hazard ratio of 0.5 in FISH positive patients. So that study, if you have a group of patients that's half of the patients and they have a hazard ratio of 0.5, you're going to have a huge increase in the cure rate. So that's a company-sponsored study. It's international. It's ongoing.
How do people respond to that and the question of off-protocol use of erlotinib in patients like that as an alternative?
Fortunately, since there's no data on that, it's not done very much. But there's probably one or two patients that I've treated that have elected to do that. That's certainly not something that I recommended, but since they were interested and wanted to do it, I didn't prevent them from doing that, because if it was me and I was FISH positive, I would do that.
If it were you, would you go into the RADIANT trial?
I might.
You know, we just submitted a paper in ASCO on a survey of medical oncologists in the United States asking them if they had colon cancer.
What would they do?
What would they do in four or five adjuvant situations? And one of the things, incidentally, that was interesting, because this is just medical
oncology. Stage 2, yeah, stage 2.
Well, the stage 2 was interesting, but kind of what they did for themselves was what they were doing for their patients, selective use of therapy. But I think the really interesting thing related to what you're talking about is what they said they'd do if they were in a very high-risk situation. We asked them, what would you do if you had 15 positive nodes, and where would participation in a trial fit in? You know, we said, okay, you could go on a trial, chemo plus or minus Bev, chemo plus or minus cetuximab, et cetera. Or you could take the treatments off protocol. And actually, I was curious, relatively few people wanted to be treated off study, which I thought was interesting, but not as many as I would have expected would have gone on a study. And a lot of them would just be treated outside of trial. I mean, to me, I think if I were in that situation, I think a study would look good.
I have a pulmonologist that went on this trial of erlotinib versus erlotinib.
Really? Alternate. The RADIANT trial?
No, this is, he's got stage 4, first line, stage 4.
Right.
But he's a physician, he's one of the
what
most...
What trial was it?
So in stage 4, I told you, for immunohistochemistry or FISH positive, we have erlotinib versus alternating chemo and erlotinib.
Right. So he went on that study?
He went on that study.
What did he get randomized to?
Both.
How did he feel about it?
He felt very good about it.
Do you think he was doing it to help future patients or help himself?
Both.
So getting back to the adjuvant situation,
right,
you talked about the RADIANT trial.
So the ECOG trial is going to be, you know, very important, okay? So
to me, that's like huge.
It's huge. And now, you don't have the pulmonary hemorrhage issue, and you don't have the brain met issue, because by definition, they don't have brain mets. By definition, they can't bleed into the lung because it just came out. And so the fraction of patients who are going to be eligible for that study is going to be high. And certainly chemo's the standard, okay? So one of the nice things about that study is it's going to answer the question, and you would expect a much higher cure rate in the bevacizumab arm. Now, if that study's positive and the RADIANT study's positive, okay, and the erlotinib plus bevacizumab study's positive, what you're going to see is people getting chemo and Bev, and then maintenance erlotinib and Bev. Even without a study, I think you would see that happen. If both of those studies are positive, my prediction is you would see a lot of that, even without a study. So ultimately, what we want to do is cure patients. And so if stuff makes people live longer in stage 4 but doesn't cure them, that's nice. But if it ends up curing a lot more people, that's going to be doubly nice. And so both of those trials are incredibly important.
And we're seeing the launch of a similar trial in breast cancer right now. Chemo plus or minus Bev. The huge colon cancer trial has already accrued. We're going to see safety data at ASCO 2008, and hopefully we're going to see some efficacy data not too long beyond that. So one of the questions is, you know, how are people going to respond to this ECOG study? And one of the interesting aspects of it is that the three allowable chemo regimens are all cis-based. And we know from our patterns of care studies that our group has just completed that while cis is the dominant platinum used by investigators, carbo is what's being used in practice. So how do you think that's going to play out?
I don't think that's going to be the dominant issue in my own practice. In fact, I, in the adjuvant setting, predominantly use cis now, which is a change from 4 or 5 years ago. And I find it better tolerated than it used to be because of amend and all the other things that have happened. You know, the issue is we've never accrued rapidly to an adjuvant trial in the U.S., and the thoracic surgeons and the medical oncologists have not been engaged together to do this. It's been a huge issue. The lung cancer study group was there to do this, and it was doing it, but not as well as the reviewers wanted it to do, but better than we've ever done. We haven't completed squat for randomized adjuvant trials. I mean, the stage 1B CALGB trial had only a few hundred patients, and it was underpowered and unfortunate to be so underpowered. And now there's going to be 3 really important adjuvant trials, and the question is, are we going to get the surgeons on board and get the medical oncologist telling the surgeons, hey, we got to put the patients on these trials? I don't think it's the CIS issue. It's whether the system, you know, is going to say, God, we can cure more patients. Let's get these patients on trial. And we need to.
Yeah, I see oncologists, you know, listening, and they're hearing the story about CIS, and I think that they're going to be open to putting patients on this study. And I think there are a lot of oncologists who put tons of people in that colon study, and patients, they don't want to recur.
Right.
And it is a promising situation. It was a very attractive. That colon study put 2,600 people on in 2 years. 2,600 people.
Well, that's what we wish we could do in lung cancer, though. But it just doesn't happen. You know, we don't have the track record of doing it. I mean, is it logical? Yes. I mean, and if you told a patient you might increase your cure rate, patients are going to be wanting to do it.
The other thing that's interesting about the trial, and again, this is all a reflection of adjuvant therapy in general, where we're at, is this issue about the 1B patient. Can you talk about how that's being handled in the trial and what your take is on the CALGB trial that sort of caused all this consternation?
Yeah, well, the CALGB trial, of course, was for 1B only, and had a initial hazard rate of 0.69. Now, the meta-analysis of the cisplatin-based regimens has a hazard rate of 0.82, okay? And 0.69 was out of the realm of, you know, all the stuff that's been published. In other words, it was too good to be true.
And they stopped the study, right?
And they stopped the study, and it was too good to be true. And the final hazard rate is 0.8. Now, a hazard rate of 0.8 is still better than a hazard rate of 0.82. The problem is, with the underpowered study, it wasn't significant. So when you start saying evidence-based medicine, you can't say it. Now you've got these ASCO guidelines that are about to come out and Canadian guidelines that are about to come out, and they're going to say 1B evidence-based medicine says no. Now, you know, if you look at the data, it's 0.8, and in the cisplatin-based stuff, it's 0.82. It's better than 0.82, but
Not to mention, it follows the same paradigm that we've seen in breast and colon cancer, which is a relative risk reduction model, events, et cetera. It's like new stuff here.
Right. And then they did a subset analysis. Of course, they found that this cutoff of 4 centimeters. Now the problem is we're going to have a new staging system, and it's 4 centimeters, not one of the cutoffs. And so that's going to even make it more confusing. The hope has to be that, unfortunately, that's my only thing I don't like about that trial, is we have to study those patients. That should make you want to study those patients more. Okay? And patients who have tumors of 3 to 4 centimeters aren't going to be included in that trial. And I think they should be. I tell people what the data are and let them choose.
How do they respond?
Differently. Some don't want it and some do. Part of it has to do with how healthy they are and how young they are and how much morbidity they've had from the surgery and so on. But it's quite variable, interestingly enough. A few people say, if you got it, doc, give it to me. And some say, you don't have any data or enough data, I don't want it.
You know, it's interesting because in breast cancer, for a long time, we've had surveys of patients. You hear the famous number of, you know, women would take adjuvant chemo for 1% reduction.
Oh, that's crazy. And they don't do that in lung. It's
okay.
Completely
well,
different.
You know, it's interesting. We actually did a survey of colon cancer patients. Same thing. We repeated the same thing and see what they said. And their responses were very similar to the breast patients, that about a third of them or more would be treated again with chemo for 1% improvement in relapse rate. The thing I found interesting was we didn't really see an age difference or a gender difference in how people, it seemed like it was more like their attitude. And yes, in lung cancer, you do have sick people, but again, you have people who aren't sick.
Right.
And, you know, what we've seen is people don't want to have cancer progression and recurrence.
Well, in lung cancer, I would say that the advocates in breast cancer have had a profound psychological effect. It used to be that cancer was a horrible thing. You wouldn't talk about it. You didn't want anybody to know. You didn't want to get treated. And breast cancer patients, advocates, have changed that whole attitude. Now, you know, if you get breast cancer, it's not such a bad thing, and you got to be a fighter. That attitude hasn't changed all that much in lung. You still have the sort of doomsday attitude, and that's part of it.
With some reason for that in terms of where we're at with lung cancer, and also because there's so few survivors of lung cancer. We just did a graphic with those numbers, which you, of course, and it's just such a devastating disease that there aren't that many survivors. When you yourself are choosing the adjuvant regimen you're going to use, and when you're putting patients, for example, in the study, you have the choice of docetaxel, gem, or vinorelbine. How do you approach that decision?
Again, I offer that to the patient. Surprisingly, the last patient I had selected navalbine, I think primarily on the basis where there's the most data. Certainly not the least toxic of the three regimens. You know, I discuss the same stuff, hair, schedule. Docetaxel is usually once every 3 weeks. Gem and navalbine are 2 out of 3 weeks. So there's some schedule differences. There's some hair differences. And I let the patients choose.
How do they usually respond?
Women generally pick gem. Men generally pick docetaxel or navalbine.
Interesting. You mentioned there were three adjuvant trials.
The third one we haven't talked about, right.
Right, what's the third
one? So the third one is MAGE. So what's MAGE? MAGE is melanoma-associated. There are antigens that are expressed on the testis during development and are frequently overexpressed on lung cancers. And GSK made this vaccine that is a combination vaccine. It's got a bunch of adjuvants in it. It's got some Toll-9 in it. It's got the MAGE antigen in it. And they did a randomized phase 2 trial of the vaccine versus, I don't know whether it was nothing or whether there was a fake vaccine. And the time to progression and survival favored the vaccine. The study was underpowered to show a difference, and the p-value was like, I don't know, 0.09 or something. So that's led them to go into a randomized vaccine trial now. And that trial, 1B, 2, and 3A patients are all eligible. So the 1Bs are eligible for that study. But, of course, you have to have your tumor tested and have the MAGE antigen in the tumor. And that's a little less than half of the patients. So that trial is going to be a tough trial to accrue to.
And adjuvant chemo is allowed?
So it's the same. It's like the Radiant trial. If you're not going to get chemo, you're randomized right away. If you're going to get chemo, you're randomized after the chemo.
Was that a national trial?
That's a company-sponsored trial. The GSK vaccine group is in Europe, so it's sort of coming out of Europe, but it's an international trial. They know they're up against a numbers issue.
Interesting.
I think that it is a different day for lung cancer. The only way to change the 5-year survival rate is to cure people. And so the only way we're going to do that is to get these studies in the adjuvant setting. And I think that that will happen. But stage 4 patients do a hell of a lot better than they did when I was starting into this business. And they have some hope and they have quality and they get 3rd, 4th line therapy. And
they die of the disease.
They die of the disease.
And so I guess one thought I have is even best case scenario, we have a completely effective adjuvant therapy. How much is that going to really impact on total lung cancer mortality since most people...
Only a quarter of the patients are early stage, right. Right, it's not going to get the 5-year survival rate up more than 20 or 25%, even if those things are really effective.
Although, yeah, the stage 3 situation where there are quite a few patients, and, you know, maybe that might be easier to improve survival or cure rate than the metastatic disease.
That's true, but we have to hope that we're going to have blood tests for early detection, not just in lung cancer, but in many cancers. You know,
think
that's,
so?
Yeah.
When?
I don't know, 5 to 10. There's a lot of leads already. If you look at the diseases, colon and breast, where we've made the most impact. It's not just screening. It's not just treatment. It's the whole gamish. And I think that's going to happen in lung. It's going to be early detection and better treatments. And the better treatments for those people who are early detected are really going to have an impact. But it's not tomorrow.
It needs to be.
Yeah.
It's a bad disease. I mean, I'm not saying anything people don't know.
Yeah. Well, we don't spend enough money on lung cancer early detection.